Hey folks, Jim here. You may know me as the co-host of the Lightest Form of Flogging podcast, released every Saturday on your favorite podcasting app. Today's episode, folks, is going to be a bit of a strange one. We have a lot of follow-up, as usual, and we spent a lot of time, well, David does, responding to comments made on the Balm and Gilead podcast by our friends Brian and Grant, and also by yours truly, on the topic of psalms as well as exclusive psalmody. So, we recommend that you listen to episode 24 of the Balm and Gilead podcast, so David's monologue will make more sense. There. You happy, David? I recorded a bumper. He always tells me what to do, and I never stand up to him. Oh, don't you shed no tears there, Jimmy boy. Here, take some whiskey. Maggie, would you let me cry in peace? Stop making me drink. As they say.
I did just send you a link to a video, which is right. Lord of the Rings, but every time Sam takes a step toward Mordor, he says it's the farthest he's ever been from home.
David, and I saw this.
It's literally what they did.
All of those videos are exactly what the title says. And I've seen a couple of those and they're fun. Like I saw the Bee movie one. What was it?
This is the first I've seen of any of these. Hold on.
Yeah, they're all over the place, man. They're all over the place. And I saw this one on LOTR and I decided not to watch it because I just didn't see the point in it. But every time he takes a step okay, this is amazing.
It's just the movie, but every once in a while, because Sam takes a step, they cut to the scene where he's in the little farm and he says his thing.
This is it. One more step. It'll be the farthest way from home I've ever been. And here he goes. All right. I went right to the spot, too, so this is perfect.
Well, the spot is everywhere.
It's wonderful music.
I know. But, like, what's really funny about this is you would think that, like, they would take, like, not each individual step, but like, oh, they took some steps. And so we'll put it at the end of this like walking sequence. But it's no, every in a 4 second, 3 step walking sequence, they play this clip three times.
This is it. The farthest away from home I've ever been. This is wonderful. Oh, and I clicked ahead about an hour.
Still happening.
They're about to hit the prancing pony and it's an hour and 40 minutes. So, oh, that was special.
Oh yeah. The video is 9 hours and 18 minutes,
which you can do on YouTube now, which is just a wonderful testament. Oh folks, we got a link to this in the show notes. You've got to see this. David and I have kind of built a small little niche in talking about LOTR from time to time. And today is no exception.
No.
We're kind of running peak LOTR discussion, soon to be taken over by our next discussion. All right, let's go ahead and start the show. Enough of this silliness. Let's get to some serious business, some serious conversation.
As you would say.
Yeah, we're going to go ahead and do this. So let's start the show.
It's French. The S is silent.
Okay.
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
Thank you, Deep Voice Man. I also welcome you to the Lightest Form of Flogging podcast. Episode 117. Wow. I am your podcast celebrity host, Jim, and sitting across the country from me at a contractually negotiated 820 miles. Oh, my brain just went crazy. Is it 24 or 20?
24, like Jack Bauer.
824 miles is my co-host, David, who, or should say, while he may not have been with me physically when I was on the Balm and Gilead podcast, he was. Also, not with me in spirit or in emotion, because that would be weird for him and for me. And so he doesn't do that. All right, David. Hey, show. We're here.
Hey, show.
Yes. I forgot to say that on that other show.
Oh, were you going to say that on the other show?
I was going to say that.
That makes sense.
He says it sometimes. Grant does. We should probably clue our audience in on what I'm talking about.
Are we getting into our first follow-up point? Just like eight words after the intro?
We might as well get right straight into it.
Because 37 words?
We're just 37
words. 43 words?
Starting right now. What are you talking about?
I'm just counting.
Okay. Just thank you. Every time Jim says something stupid, David counts up. I want to say that.
58 words.
Yes. Are you seriously counting?
No, I'm not that autistic.
I was gonna say, David, you are a marvel. You're a marvel, I say.
So you were gonna explain.
Yes, thank you, David. So, Jim, you were saying that really interesting thing. No, folks, we'll go ahead and get right into follow-up here. I guested on a fellow podcast. I'm not sure how to refer to them as. I want to say sister podcast, but that's weird.
Right, because they're
Let's
men.
Let's just say they're another podcast in the Tech Reformation podcast family.
They're a cousin podcast, but they could also be a sister podcast because both of the podcasts are from Alabama.
Okay. That is true. What a coincidence. No. I guessed it on the Balm and Gilead podcast with Grant and Brian. Wonderful podcast. Fellow Slack people for the longest time. And they started a podcast on, I guess you could say, it's a Christian podcast about music in general. That would be a general way of describing it. Mm-hmm. We get into some deeper topics as to, you know, how to evaluate good worship music.
Worship music.
As the Reformed say, ridiculously so, but I don't judge ever. I guessed it on the show it was released yesterday. My goodness, that was just the other day. So I'm recording many podcasts during the week now because I'm just so busy. And I had a lot of fun. So I hope you guys are going to go on over to the Balm and Gilead podcast website and check it out. We'll go ahead and throw it in the show notes, which I won't remember to send to David. So why even bother saying this in front of everybody? But it was a fun time. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about Psalms. We talked about the RPW. We even had a bonus episode because we talked about politics. And we just talked about a whole lot of things. It was a lot of fun. So
I have not listened to the bonus episode, but I did listen to the episode.
Oh, good. So, well, you won't really learn anything new from the bonus episode. We talked a little bit about politics and
how you're a Trump supporter now.
Yes, I confessed. It was breaking news revealed to everyone that I know. Go ahead and check that out, folks. A lot of fun, and hope you enjoy it. Next up.
Next up is why Jim hates the man. No, I'm going to actually...
You're silly.
We'll do that one in a minute. I should just mention for anybody concerned, because I hear people are concerned when you get COVID, that I am, I think, at about 98% capacity. I can now go up and down the stairs without getting winded. Like, not like seven times, because, you know, yes, I'm still out of shape. But
when Sarah goes up and down the stairs, she still can't make it.
She's still,
you don't even care.
She's still struggling. I mean, she's definitely doing better, but I'd say she's at more like 82%. Still just tired. And we both had this thing where it just kind of felt like, so we went from being achy all over to then
worst.
Just feeling like physically weak. Like your muscles are just kind of tired. Sarah described it as like once you get done with a workout. Yeah. Fatigue, but like muscle fatigue.
Yeah.
Without pain. Okay. So that was kind of weird. And she's still in that phase now.
Man, that would be awful.
But
what did you guys do? Do you just like lay around? I mean, what can you?
Yeah,
do?
I mean, I would maybe work an hour or two each day, just on my laptop on the couch, and then, we watched a lot of movies. We watched all the Monarch movies, the Godzilla Kong movies. There's three of them. We watched all three of those because we'd never seen any of them, and we watched them.
Oh, really? Did you like them?
So we watched that. We did like them. We watched them in exactly the wrong order. We watched the most recent one. Then watched the second most recent one. And it was after we watched the second most recent one that we realized it was a series. And then we said, I wonder if there are any more. And the only one left was the one.
The original Godzilla.
The 2014 Godzilla. So the reason this happened was like a friend at church told us that we should watch the Godzilla movies because he's really into Godzilla. He thinks it's a really cool thing.
And so we thought, okay, you know, we'll take note of that. And so we watched the most recent one just thinking, oh, there's no relation to these other movies.
Yeah.
And then iTunes, because of that, recommended Kong. And so we watched that and we're like, oh, this is the same universe.
Yes. Well, you know what? I've seen those movies. I don't think it was, I mean, you're not losing out.
No,
on
I
so
didn't
much.
Feel like we, like, yeah.
It wouldn't be like if you watched Return of the King first.
Or the Marvel Avengers movies in the wrong order.
Yeah, like the second Avengers, Infinity War, whatever that one was, Endgame. That would be a...
Endgame and then Infinity War. That would be disappointing.
Yes. But no, so yeah, I'm a fan of those movies. The King Kong was kind of cool, but the Godzilla movies I like them a lot.
Yeah,
did you like the King? What's his name? The villain in the second Godzilla movie, that was kind of a cool.
Oh yeah, the multi-headed serpent thing. Yeah, my first impression of him was that the character design was not very good, but I think it was because the heads were just like shut. And so like their mouths were shut.
Okay.
And they just kind of looked funky. And then for the rest of the movie, I was like, oh no, this looks great. Like this looks fantastic. But when their mouths are closed, they just kind of look like dead sock puppets or something.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, I saw some behind the scenes footage, as they say, and they had three different actors do, what's it called? Motion capture.
Oh.
And they tried to do three different personalities.
That's
interesting. I don't think it really came across that well.
Yeah, but I didn't catch it.
They tried.
Yeah. But yeah, so we watched movies. We napped a lot, you know, because I have asthma and there's the potential because I have asthma for me to wind up in the hospital. And so we just decided to take it fairly seriously.
Did you have problems breathing, David?
No, well, I mean, it was not.
That's a thing, right?
Yeah, my breathing was not optimal, but it was better than if I had just like run for a minute. Like it was just.
Okay.
A little bit hard sometimes to get a deep breath, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's good because I kind of forgot that one of the chief symptoms of COVID was a difficulty breathing or respiratory problems.
Yeah.
And, you know, you, asthma, I had some childhood asthma. I don't have the greatest lungs in the world. When I get a cough, it turns into death a month later. So I'm certainly not wanting this disease.
That reminds me when I was in Israel in the Dead Sea area. Our host told us that if we're feeling thirsty, we need to drink water. Like drink water even if you're not feeling thirsty. Drink a lot of water.
Okay.
Drink a lot of water. Drink a lot of water. Because what'll happen is first you'll feel thirsty and then about an hour later you'll start to get a headache and then immediately you'll die.
that gave me COVID. That's pretty bad. How old were you when you heard that?
Oh, I was like 22.
Oh, you were too old for such silliness. So
yeah, I've always been too old for such silliness.
Indeed, yes.
That's why I'm not even on the show anymore.
No, you're not even here. It's just me doing your voice.
Not even in spirit.
So, all right, cool.
Or emotionally.
No spirit, no emotion, no physical. David is not available in those ways to me. All right. So I guess sequentially I'm next.
Yes, you are. Yes.
Quick follow-up point for everybody. No real reason why I'm saying this other than it's just amazing. Chick-fil-A has opened in Spokane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And guess what happened, David?
They immediately had to close because of COVID.
No.
They went out of business.
They handed out one chicken sandwich and said, all right, guys, thanks.
An Antifa guy wearing a C4 vest blew it up.
I was worried about that, but I don't think that has happened. Well, you are familiar with the Spokane area, right?
Of course
I
am.
You lived there once. It was once your abode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a drone video that flew or traveled across over the top of that area. It's by the Y. In Spokane, there's a place called the Y. There's a main drag called Division. It eventually separates into like a Y intersection, so we call it the Y. And that's where it is, David. And that whole area became completely congested. Do you remember? Or do you remember that area?
Well, wait. We're just talking about where it splits into Division and Ruby?
Yes. No, farther down the road from there. That's way south.
Okay.
So go farther north. There's a dealership up there. There's a Rite Aid.
Right.
There's a Total Wine and More up there.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, now David got it. Oh, yeah, got it. That's where I get my hooch.
I honestly did not go up north very much at all. And so I didn't know that was called the Y.
Okay. Well, anyways, I want you to check your phone because I want you to see the drone video.
Okay.
So you get an idea of the congestion that Chick-fil-A, because so folks, while David is looking that up, no matter where Chick-fil-A is, in the United States, they are known for having very, very long drive-through lines. But because they are so efficient, it's never usually an issue. People just sail right through the lines. Well, Chick-fil-A opened in Spokane, and I'm showing David a video of what the car lines looked like. Started at midnight last night.
Wait, are those two independent lines coming in from?
I don't know if those are independent. I'm not familiar with the configuration exactly of the drive-through window, or if you can order in two places.
At the intersection, there are cars waiting on what seems like either side.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what that is, but just they're everywhere. The line goes into the main drag of Division.
Yeah. Yeah.
It goes past the Walmart. It snakes around blocks, David. That is the power of chicken. I just wanted to share that with you.
Behold the power of chicken.
Here for you. So that's pretty crazy. So I'm looking forward to finally getting a bite of a waffle fry sometime next year. So.
That is crazy, Jim.
Yeah, it's nuts. Nuts.
So next up, I have, there was some discussion on Slack after some things that Jim said last week. And I thought I would just open up the mic for Jim to explain why he hates The Mandalorian.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, David, for giving me this opportunity. I feel so blessed. Hashtag and brave. Yes, to give this account of my hatred of The Mandalorian. No, I believe my criticism still stands, but because for Pete's sake, Mando landed on this planet and went on a freaking mission for somebody.
No, he didn't.
To go destroy somebody else. It's happening every single freaking episode.
He passed up a mission to go on a different mission.
Distinction without a difference, my friend.
You're a distinction you're without a difference.
I've been told. But no. But that being said, my kids were watching with me, and they're huge fans of the Clone Wars animated series.
Right.
And Ahsoka, the very popular Jedi character, was in that series, and they just became enthralled with her, and they were so happy to see her on screen. Mm. And I was just thinking, wow, she looks just like what I would think she would look like if she were real. Mm. And she is real. She's real, David. Don't tell me she's not.
I didn't.
And it was a great episode, really great episode. So I just want to say that I'm satisfied. Like you said, you used a great word last week. You said,
"Estoy satisfecho."
Oh yes, you said that. So you're satisfied by this show, but you slightly do agree with me that they're kind of reusing plot devices and reusing story devices, and they're just not really giving up with it. But maybe they're doing that on purpose to prove that we don't care. We just want more. And they're right. They're right. And I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just saying that that's exactly what they're doing every single episode, and we're all watching. So who's the fool now? It's me, I know.
The fool or the fool who follows him?
Yes. So I just want to point that out. That's all I want to say.
Okay.
And everyone's so mad at me.
All right. Everybody, you can calm down. You now understand why Jim hates The Mandalorian.
Thank you. I just wanted to have that chance, that one chance.
Next up, I have what might be called an epic follow-up point. I just kind of decided it was time. I needed to do this. Jim's been pressuring me to talk about theology for some time now. And so I am going to filibuster by talking about The Lord of the Rings.
Yes, we can milk this sucker for a while. So
listeners may recall that the Lord of the Rings was being digitally remastered, as some would say, in 4K or 2160p, 3840 by 2160, Dolby Vision HDR.
My goodness.
And I received this as a gift from Apple. Came to my iTunes account for free. Aww. Because 4 to 5 years ago, I bought the 1080p versions. These are the extended editions, by the way.
Right. Yes. I've seen these.
And I have to say that this was a much better surprise than getting an unrequested Rolling Stones album.
though thrilling.
Do you remember that? Apple did a developer conference, and at the end of it, they gave everybody a free Rolling, like literally everybody who had an iTunes account got a free Rolling Stones album, new Rolling Stones album. And so many people called to complain or were like just confused because they didn't keep up with the Apple news, and they're just like, why is this in my iTunes? I think maybe I got somebody else's album.
Or as David said, what the frick am I supposed to do with this?
Exactly. Although it wasn't worth $4,000.
Good point.
I think at their age now, they're just called the Rolling Kidney Stones. Isn't that right?
Yes. If they're shriveled up.
So anyway, I guess that's not really funny because you can get a kidney stone as a young man. I think it depends on your calcium intake.
It is a young man's game, as they say.
Anyway, Sarah and I are both planning to watch these over the next 3 or 4 weeks.
On your big screen.
One a week, give or take, on the big screen, the 55-inch Sony that we have. And it is not OLED, but it is a good LED panel, LCD LED, as you would say.
Will it be a good presentation, David?
I believe so.
Okay, good.
Do you make do you still make an effective team?
What?
Oh, that's we watched another movie. It was it's that Tom Cruise movie.
Do we still make an effective team?
Tom Cruise, Jupiter Moon.
Jupiter Moon?
Yeah.
Oh, Oblivion.
Oblivion. Yeah.
Yes. I saw that in the theater.
It wasn't great. It wasn't bad. It wasn't great.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was better than The Last Jedi. I will give you that, Jim. Anyway, so
I should think so.
I haven't watched them, but caring a lot, as listeners know, about the visual effects and how those were remastered, I skimmed through some key scenes on my phone, most notably the Balrog scene. Some of the scenes surrounding the elves, they had that like soft glow filter on the footage previously.
Yep.
And then also I watched some of the footage of when the Ents take over Isengard.
Did you watch any scene where they used the, I don't know what it's called, massive attack. That's not what I'm talking about. Anyways, you know what I'm talking about in the battle scenes where they animated the little guys. They were all individually animated through artificial intelligence. Do you remember that?
No, I thought, are you thinking during of most, The Hobbit?
No. They used this in LOTR.
Oh.
So in a lot of the battle scenes, it's a wide, far away shot and they're showing just, you know, hundreds or thousands of people fighting and they're all individually animated. But it was like an automated function because of a computer program that they invented or developed where
crowd
they could have, what's that?
I think they're called crowd simulations. I didn't realize they had those in the early 2000s.
Yes. Well, it was, I think they developed it for the movie.
Okay.
And they hadn't used it before, but all of those individual little guys fighting were all doing individual things. So it looked very authentic.
Right.
And they could do it in an automated way. And I was just wondering if you saw any battle scenes and how that looked.
No, I have not yet, but I will have seen the, I guess they don't really have any of those in the first movie in the Fellowship.
They do when they're in the Mines of Moria and all the orcs.
Oh, okay. Them. So I'll keep an eye out for it there. But I did skim through the scenes that I mentioned on my phones, which probably has the best display of any device in my house. I just had to hold it very close to my face.
It's also slightly smaller than your Sony.
Slightly. Yes. Yeah, I think it's 5.5 inches, not 55. So some things that they very clearly did. They did what's called HDR, or HDR, as Jim would say, remastering, where essentially the way that you typically think about brightness, they work a little bit differently, where like when you typically think about brightness, a white sheet of paper might be true white. But when you do HDR remastering, you make true white like a white sheet of paper, and then you have like ultra brights for things that are supposed to appear to actually be glowing. So what that results in is basically just brighter brights. It gives you like 30% brighter, like up to 30% brighter that you can apply to certain things in your scene. Like when the camera looks at the sun should of course be 30. I mean, it should be more than 30%. It should be orders of magnitude brighter than anything on the screen. But if you did that,
could you
people
just
would go
shut
blind.
Up about the sun. Thank you. Finally, I need to redeem myself.
Finally.
Okay, keep going.
So anyway, one of the things I complained about, and really this is my biggest complaint, because when I look at The Lord of the Rings and I think, oh, like what could they have done better given the technology they have at the time? There's not a lot to say. Like they did the very best that they could. But several of the elf scenes, especially surrounding Galadriel, had this soft glow effect where it kind of looked like they shot the scene through like very, very thin wax paper. I suspected, because back at that time, they would actually do this they would actually hold some foggy sheet of plastic in front of the lens to get this effect. And I suspect that that's what they had done, and that's just how that footage was. But if you watch the new 4K versions, there is still a glow, but it feels more like a filmic glow. It feels more realistic. It feels less like a bad Photoshop filter from 2003.
Okay. I did notice that at the time that there was a bit of a, like a, not a faded glow, but like, yeah, it's like a, like wax paper was put in front of the camera. Yeah. It never bothered me. Maybe like it did you, because you're being a tech guy, you kind of notice these things.
Yeah.
You're being a visual guy, but that's improved. So that's
good. It's much improved. I think what they said happened was that the standard definition version, the effect that they applied looked good for the standard definition version. But then when they did the Blu-ray versions, they just kind of upscaled it and it did not look good.
Okay. Well, a lot of things did not look good in that HD version, in my opinion.
Yeah. So
the effects didn't catch up with the rest of the live action stuff.
The other thing that they clearly did was they up-resed, meaning they raised the resolution of the scans. They sharpened everything. And they did denoising where it was needed, because there were a few shots that were a little bit noisy.
Could you define that for me?
And basically, you just remove the noise. When you have an image that has a lot of film grain, you do what you can to preserve the detail that's there while also eliminating the noise. And there's several different ways of doing that. Some like Topaz involve artificial intelligence, like actual machine learning algorithms that are trained to pick out noise. And then there's also my preferred solution for this is called Neat Video, which is a fairly cheap plugin that I've had for years now that does not use machine learning at all, but is just really good at it for some reason. So they did that, and then I think they might have trimmed down some of the Gandalf fighting the Balrog scenes in the beginning of the Two Towers to cut out some of the more egregiously bad / awkward shots. I'm not 100% positive on this, but I watched this sequence the most and I feel like it was a little bit shorter. But I haven't like compared them one to one.
I don't think many LOTR fans would want a newly released version to be shorter, to have anything cut out.
Well, but there were really, some really, you know what I mean, cringy shots, I think, in that falling fight sequence.
In the Two Towers.
That's what I'm talking about. I think that sequence is a little bit shorter.
I don't know
if it's more than like 20% shorter, like maybe 10% shorter. And I think they might have just said, you know what? We don't need these three little 2-second clips or whatever.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So in terms of what they have not done, we talked about how they might completely redo the visual effects. They did not do that. I don't think 80% of the shots really needed to be redone. I mean, a lot of what they did was practical effects. A lot of what they did was, you know, we need an explosion here. So let's get a crew out here with some explosives and let's film an explosion. There are a few things I wish they had done that they did not. So the fire effect, specifically on the Balrog, and maybe in a couple other places. At the time of the release, fire effects were some of the hard... I have extensive notes here, by the way, so if it sounds like I'm reading, it's because I am. At the time of the release, feel free to interrupt though, Jim. Fire effects were some of the hardest things to do in CGI, except, I mean, like taking existing footage of fire and compositing it onto... you know, like a car to make it look like the car is on fire. That was relatively easy. But in terms of doing simulations of fire in 3D software and then compositing that in, it was very, very difficult. And the reason...
Fire does not behave in very predictable ways. It's very chaotic.
But actually...
If you stare at a fire, how could you program that?
Well, that's the thing, is like fire particles, if you will, like burning carbon and then smoke particles, do behave in extremely predictable ways. What's unpredictable about it from the perspective of somebody watching is like, you don't understand all the things that are going into making the fire do what it's doing. Like all the little things.
Fuel
like,
source.
And- yeah. So this fuel source is burning hotter, whereas this one is burning colder. And so that creates kind of a vortexy effect, because you've got hot air and cold air both in the same area, and the one wants to expand into the other. And then that creates heat, and you've also just got whatever wind and the fact that this person just walked by. You've got all these different things. But like, I think at this time they had largely figured out how to simulate that. How, and the way that you do it is you get thousands of little particles and you make sure that they have an attraction to each other that mimics the attraction that these burning carbon particles have. And then you, or burning whatever particles have, and then you, so you have them behaving that way. You say, oh, okay, you guys need to, you need to rise because of the heat, and you need to cling to each other with this much viscosity. Basically, you need to cling to each other this much and be willing to break apart under these circumstances. And then you, you throw in some forces, you throw in some wind forces, you throw in various things. And what you get is a sort of grid of dots that describe where there is and is not fire and smoke, and describes at that dot how dense the fire or smoke is. And then after that, you, you based on that data, you, you kind of add what are called shaders that would apply to a point in space based off of how much fire and smoke is in that area and how dense it is.
Okay.
So to do this well, you need like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of particles, so that your grid that describes the fire can be as tight as possible. This gets you the best resolution on the fire and also the most correct behavior. And as I mentioned, these particles will be affected by things like wind, the density of existing dust in the air, the heat of the fire, the movement of the fire generator, any objects in the path of the fire slash smoke. And in a good simulation, even things like what is being burnt. I would guess that the number of particles that they had to work with, just because of the limitations of computers at the time, was probably 1 to 4 orders of magnitude below what consumer hardware can do with like free software these days. And more like 8 orders of magnitude below what production houses like Pixar or Industrial Light and Magic are doing.
Well,
and so, yeah, I mean, you just don't have the data there. Now there are tricks that you can do when you don't have enough particles. So one effect of not having enough particles is that the fire smoke doesn't look very detailed. And then one trick to getting around that is to add fake detail. So it's like somebody goes in Photoshop using the warp brush or the smudge brush and just kind of jiggles the fire particles around randomly, like just jostles them. Like, that is one way to get what appears to be detail. But the problem is that if you lean on it too heavily, the fire just kind of looks random and chaotic. It doesn't feel natural because you're seeing the technical term here is turbidity. You're seeing turbidity, but it doesn't correspond to the environment. It doesn't behave like when the Balrog slashes his arm, the turbidity stays the same pattern of like noisy jiggliness that it does when he's holding his arm still, because like the whole point of this is that you don't have the data there. So you're just making stuff up. And I think they leaned a little bit too heavy on it. It might have actually looked a little bit better if they added less turbidity or less detail and just let it be kind of blobby and amorphous, but be like realistic but vague, if that makes sense. So anyway, there wasn't much that they could do to fix this without like completely resimulating things. I do think that in some shots they might have had an artist go in by hand and almost frame by frame clean stuff up. That's the other way that you can add fake detail, is you get an artist to look at that and say, oh, the fire should probably look like it's doing this, which is almost better than doing the simulation, because sometimes the simulation will do something that's completely realistic. But because we know it's CGI, we'll look at it and be like, oh, that's not realistic. And you have to like get an artist in there who says, no, it should be like that. But in order to look believable, it needs to be like this, which is not realistic.
Like the guy in the Star Wars re-release, who when Jabba the Hutt came out, he said, that's not realistic.
Worst movie ever.
Ever.
You know, that's the same voice as Homer Simpson.
Dan Castellaneta,
yeah,
does that guy?
Yeah, and the same voice as, he does like so many voices on that show. He does Sideshow Mel. He does, I think he does Duff Man. He does so many voices on that show. It was shocking to me when I realized this.
Yeah, Hank Azaria does a bunch. He does, I think, Mary Quimby or Quibby.
Yeah.
Harry Shearer does a bunch. Oh, they're great. Anyways.
Anyway, Lord of the Rings. So I think they may have had an artist clean up some of the shots. And that's very painstaking, because what you do is you basically find a frame, you draw fire, then you skip forward a few frames and you manipulate the fire a little bit. Then you skip forward a few frames and you manipulate the fire a little bit. And
okay.
So I don't think they did
just like that
very much of this. But anyway, the other nice thing is like, it's not very many scenes. Lots of the fire is done with real fire. So this is mostly about the fire that you can't you can't just like, oh, well, let's bring in a real Balrog. Like, we can't do that. So we're going to have to CGI it. And then there's some water effects.
We need to call in Greg. Greg, we can't call him in. He's so hard to find. And you know how expensive he is? We got to bring him in. Okay, come on in, Greg. Hey, guys, I'm here. Can we just get this done? I know.
You're setting the drapes on fire.
Look, I can't help it. I'm a Balrog, all right? Anyways.
Oh,
break
man.
The Balrog.
You know what his teacher said when he was failing third grade?
What?
You shall not pass. All right,
and
that was not
why
good.
He gets so upset. No, it's so good. It's going in the beginning of the show.
There were also water effects, and water effects work basically the same way. You get particles and you simulate their viscosity. You simulate their attraction to each other, their tendency to cling to each other. They didn't do very much with water effects, but I'm pretty sure that they did it in the scenes where the Ents attack Isengard. I think they didn't do it as the dams are breaking. I think that they actually like built dams.
That was real water, I think, wasn't
but
it?
But I think when it floods Isengard, like when you watch it come in, I'm pretty sure that's, well, because they've got the CGI Ents and the water is being affected by the Ents.
Yeah, you're right.
Think those scenes, and these actually, I think they look a lot better than the fire, but something about them at times just feels a little bit unnatural. I think they covered a lot of it with foam because they couldn't get like really good water, but it's easier to fake foam because foam is just kind of like random particles of water. Right. So anyway, and then lastly, Gollum. I'm pretty sure they didn't change him at all. The effects they did to get the skin right. So getting skin right involves what's called subsurface scattering. And if you want to know what that is, just hold a flashlight to your hand and watch how like the area around the flashlight. And even if you turn your hand around, you'll see like the webbing between your fingers turns like bright orange. And that's because the light comes in and beneath the surface, it scatters and then shoots back out. The effects that they used to get his skin right were very hard to do when the movie was made. And the methods that they were using are now slightly inferior to what modern video games do 60 to 140 times a second. Like they probably had like 60 computers working on rendering Gollum and they were churning out like a frame an hour, something along those lines. And now like, oh, my iPhone does that like 60 times a second.
Man, David, I almost didn't want to know that. I mean, do you know how groundbreaking it was when Gollum came out?
Yeah.
It was just amazing. I think it still holds up.
It's not bad.
Most of the scenes.
But he does look a little bit plasticky. And the other thing that stood out to me was that the level of detail on the motion capture, where the actor's face moves and they use that to manipulate Gollum's face, that movement, with little ping pong balls and painted dots on his face. Yeah. There just isn't as much detail. And so when you look at Gollum, you feel like, I'm seeing a lot of detail in his face because they up-res the footage and you can see all the little pores on his nose and wrinkles in it. But when he like smiles or, you know, gets angry or whatever, you don't see the wrinkles in his face react with as much detail. And so he feels just a little bit wooden.
It's occurring to me that your level of analysis is just so high above everybody else. You're like, I like Lord of the Rings, and I don't know what to say. I think he doesn't want me to like it. I don't know what to do.
I'm still really, really excited.
This is interesting to
see
me.
These. Like,
I bet you.
None of this takes away from it for me. These are the things where they didn't do. I'm so glad that they got, because when I look at Gollum, I'm like, well, that was the best they could do. Like, they literally physically could throw 100 more computers at it, and still all they would get is crashes if they tried to add more detail. Like,
interesting. Okay.
Well, because it's things like RAM limitations, and you can't get around that if your computers can only have each a maximum of 64 gigs of RAM, you can't get around the fact that you can't store more detail than that.
Mine have 65.
Well, if you buy a Mac Pro, you can get a terabyte and a half of RAM.
What? Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So anyway, I don't remember why I would say, the soft glow, the fact that they fixed the soft glow just makes me so happy, because when I look at all the things that I didn't like, the soft glow was one where it's like, no, you could have done better. You just had a poor sense of taste. Like, it was just a bad choice. And the fact that they fixed that, and now there's still a glow, but it just looks a lot classier.
Right. They are elves after all, magical elves. They need a little bit of glow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, especially Galadriel. Like, that makes sense. But
yes.
I'm very excited. Sarah and I are going to be watching them over the next 3 or 4 weeks, and I will probably make this a follow-up point each time, but with slightly less detail.
Yes. We will cover Aragorn's beard detail. Because wouldn't you know it, he was actually animated. No. the whole time. Well, that was pretty interesting, David. I mean, my fandom of LOTR knows no bounds, and apparently... The CGI in the movie does not disinterest me at all. This is actually very interesting to listen through. But I mean, you single-handedly like have me weirded out whenever I see a Balrog, you know, whether it's in a movie or on the street. But no, like when I watch that, I'm not going to be able to get you out of my head. So that's the only criticism I have of you is you've ruined the Balrog for me. But then again, when I see, you know, Gandalf flying down the shaft, as he gets Glamdring, I will say, well, David was kind of right here. So
it's very true. Are you going to rewatch them? Are you? I mean,
yeah. Me and a friend are going to be watching them soon.
Excellent.
We're going to do one movie like every Friday. So just take three Fridays and watch one movie, so we can kind of let it sink in. I used to just watch those movies just all the way through.
Oh no, can't do it.
And that's just not right anymore. I have children. I have life. I have a job. But I want to get back into kind of watching a movie and thinking about it for a week and then watching the next one and thinking about it for a week. I think that'll make it much more enjoyable. So
excellent.
Well, all right. Well, let's transition, David, to a follow out segment,
which we never
do that. We never do. This is very curious, and we are so close to running out of time. I'm really glad we did this today because we're just not going to be able to fit in everything. So, all right, let's go ahead and talk about follow out. So yes, I was on a show. David did listen to it and he has some thoughts, doesn't he?
Yeah. So Jim was recently on an episode of the Blarney Stone of Gillette, the best a normative principle adherent can get.
The guys will like that.
And you guys talked.
certainly not the bra of Galadriel, but this is pretty good too.
Was that one on the show in the episode? I think it made
its way through. I don't know. Wow. Maybe I didn't think of that.
Wow. All right. Let's see. Next up. No, not next up. We're still doing the same thing. You just threw me for a loop, Jim.
Can I just say we're doing a follow-up segment from someone else on the thing said from someone else's show.
That's follow-out. That's definitionally what follow-out is.
Oh, follow-out.
Yeah.
Okay. Follow-out. Can I do a real-time follow-up before we go to
follow-out? You
follow-out?
Can, yeah.
That software that I told you about, it is called Massive. Software package developed by Stephen Religious for the visual effects industry. Its flagship feature is the ability to quickly and easily create thousands of agents that all act as individuals, opposed to content creators individually animated.
Used on Game of Thrones.
Throw that in there.
Yeah, it's actually the behavior of crowds is surprisingly easy to mathematically predict and recreate. Anyway,
David says, "Oh, no big deal. It's surprisingly easy to replicate."
Well, no, it's just when you sometimes you think about things like, "Oh, how fire works," and you look at the equations in the white papers, which occasionally I do, even though I can't understand them at all. And you're like, "Oh, this is like three pages long." And then you look at like how crowd simulations or swarming is done, and you're like, "Oh, this is like algebra 2 and it's like four lines long." And that's how crowd simulations are. But anyway,
perfect.
So you guys talked a little bit about your experience with the Psalms, and I had some thoughts on some things that you said, Jim. And I also just felt like, well, gee, if you guys get to talk about your experience with the Psalms, I can talk about my experience with the Psalms. Now, this is the women's Bible study equivalent to a theology segment. I'm not going to talk so much about the theology as I'm going to talk about my experiences and feelings. So there, Jim.
Amy Bird is going to be so mad at you.
No, I feel like she would actually be on my side here.
Great. What an ally.
Carl Truman, on the other hand. Anyway, so Jim, why don't you just summarize? I realize I'm putting you on the spot here, but can you briefly summarize what you said about your experience with the Psalms? Or do you think that would be helpful for this?
Sure.
Context wise,
I'll make it brief. So the guys asked me how if my views of the Psalms have changed over the years, and they indeed have. So I used to approach the Psalms past a few years ago in a very particular way. It wasn't a very helpful way, but I don't believe I was a very good interpreter of the Psalms. I don't think I was a very good reader, student. I did not approach the Psalms in a good way, and I think the reason why is because I didn't know how to, I didn't know what they meant. I couldn't unlock the meaning. I couldn't get the relevance. Not, maybe that's too strong of a word, but what I used to do when I read the Psalms was, in many ways, I was trying to get theology out of it, trying to extract theology out of the Psalms. What can I learn about God? What kind of attribute can I take out of these Psalms or this particular Psalm and add to the doctrine of God that I have in my head? So I was essentially kind of systematizing the Psalms and kind of extracting value out of them. And I was like dismissing the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. And I did that for so long. And thusly, I could never really find deep meaning in the Psalms. I don't believe that I could pull out of them what I was supposed to, and went through a challenging time in my life, and believe that I found the Psalms anew, and it was in a collection of things and events and attitudes that kind of helped me change. One of them was, you told me that John Calvin said that the Psalms were the anatomy of the soul, and that was, it really unlocked the door for me. In some ways, as to how I can approach the Psalms, and they opened up for me, and they all of a sudden became so much more meaningful than they used to be. And my appreciation is—it's like a word I don't even like using, because I don't think one should just, you know, appreciate the Psalms. I don't think that's how you should approach the Bible or anything in the Bible. But my appreciation, my gratitude, my ability to find deeper meaning in the Psalms changed after a couple of years ago, in part because I learned that, and you told me that. It was from our discussions, our various discussions in the past about the Psalms, and my attitude changed completely. So we talked a little bit about Psalms and worship. Barely scratched the surface of an exclusive psalmody, a few comments around that topic. And the guys had a similar experience where, you know, before they couldn't get much out of the Psalms, and now they get an immense amount. And a few things had to change, some interpretive things, hermeneutics, disposition, place in life. But it finally happened. So that's what we talked about. Did I miss anything?
No, I think that was a pretty accurate summary of all the things that you guys talked about. Which I thought would be helpful, just because some of this is me. One of the things you guys mentioned was that you haven't been to an exclusive psalmody church. And from what it sounds like, you guys don't have, and I don't say this to like make you feel bad, until I started attending a psalm singing church.
You already make me feel bad.
What?
You already make me feel bad.
I know, but I'm not trying to. That's all. That's the point.
Good. That's all the difference.
Which
right
might
there.
Make you feel worse. I don't know.
No, it feels great.
I did not have much experience singing psalms until I started attending a psalm singing church. Like I dabbled with trying to sing some things to some from the Scottish Metrical Psalter to old hymn tunes, but it's hard. It's hard when you don't have people around you singing. It's hard when you're not encouraged to do it every week. It's hard when you feel kind of silly because you're the only one in the room doing it, or it's just you and your wife. And so I come to this from a different perspective now, because for the last 11 months, or so, I have been attending an exclusive psalmody church, and we've sang a lot of psalms. And so I thought it might be helpful to present some things that I've noticed, differences from singing modern worship songs and hymns, and then just compare and contrast a little bit, I guess. Right. And so I wanted to start by saying that some of the psalms are really hard to sing. And I don't mean that like I'm trying for the descant or anything. I mean that there are times when we're called to sing about our hatred of sin, our love of righteousness, how much we love the church, how we love it when the Bible corrects us, how people who do wicked things that sometimes we do, will be punched in the jaw by God's justice. Like, it can be uncomfortable to sing about that. And I have to remind myself, because of that, like, I have to self-police and remind myself of the gospel as I sing them, because otherwise the songs don't make sense.
Why is that uncomfortable? Is it because you've been trained to sing other songs and this change produces kind of a reaction in you, or that they are inherently uncomfortable to sing about?
I think they are. Well, I think they become more comfortable the further along you might progress in sanctification.
Well, sure.
But I think they are. There is a sense in which they're inherently uncomfortable to sing about. Like, we don't like, for some good reasons, to reflect on how God is going to punish the wicked. Like,
are you sure?
I mean, some people do for wicked reasons, but I think that overall, like, our our attitude toward God's judgment is not generally one of like, yay. And it, not, I don't know that it should be.
Well, sure. This is, seems to be hard to, that's a hard judgment to make. Don't you think? How do you know?
How do I know what?
That people don't like to, wouldn't like to sing about that because they think improperly about God's judgment on people.
I'm not saying that they think improperly on it. I'm saying that, like, I don't know. Like, if you had just been pulled from a burning car, like, there are a lot of things that you might want to sing about, but one of those things is not how painful it is to die melting and burning alive in a car. Like,
well, this is realistic examples. I like it.
I'm trying.
I'm following you.
And like, God's justice is something that is supposed to terrify us. And maybe you're right. Maybe there is right. a cultural element of, like, I grew up my entire life singing about things that were not scary, things that didn't make me go, oh, like, I'd yep. better, I better be careful. Yep. I better repent, because, like, if I don't, like, what I'm singing about is for me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, once saved, always saved. I do believe that, but there's a sense in which salvation manifests itself in ongoing repentance and faith. And
yeah,
the feeling of backsliding or the feeling of just having had a bad morning, when you come to church and sing about how God's going to punch all the wicked right in the jaw with his justice, and they're going to burn. And, you know, it's like that song, Revelation 21:8, 21:8, liars go to hell, liars go to hell, burn, burn, burn. Like, there are some Psalms where you feel like, is that my what goodness. I'm singing? I think that's what I'm singing. Like, yeah. And you have to yeah. remind yourself of the gospel. You have to remind yourself that God's justice is a good thing and that you've been spared because of Christ.
I agree.
And then some of them are weird to sing because it's kind of like hearing a sermon come out of your mouth. We've been singing, we sang a couple times in the last few weeks, Psalm 131:1. One of the verses there goes, Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor mine eyes lofty, neither do I exercise myself in great matters or in things too high for me. I've never heard a sermon about this passage. I've never heard a sermon that warns me not to occupy myself with things that are above my head, above my pay grade, or above the knowledge that God has been pleased to reveal in Scripture. But all of this hit me while singing. Like I was singing this line and I was like, oh, I'm singing that I haven't done these things, that I haven't spent too much time on theological matters that are too great for me, but I have. And the Psalm called me to repentance. And to remember that the only reason I could sing the words I was singing was because Christ wrote them and sings them with our congregation as our covenant head. Otherwise, I would be the heaviest form of hypocrite. And, okay. and that's different. Like, I've never had that sensation from even some of the best hymns where it's like, oh, I can't sing this. Like, this is convicting for me. And yeah, so there's that.
Okay.
I should say there may be hymns and modern songs that do things like the above, but I have to say I experience things like this multiple times in a month, like sometimes multiple times in a service. My general impression is that singing psalms is almost a fundamentally different act than singing even some of the most deep theological hymns like In Christ Alone or Before the Throne. My experience is that while many hymns and man-made songs build up, the psalms cut down in a way that's very uncommon in man-made songs. Like, I legitimately feel afraid sometimes in singing them. And I am both, I am by the words, by the sermon that follows, by my own knowledge of the scriptures and by the spirit within me, pushed to recall and apply the gospel. Because if I didn't, the song would just scare me.
Yeah. I know you're speaking from personal experience. So I don't want to forget that. I'm wondering, like, the degree to which a man-made song can do this. Do you believe that a man-made song can produce and has produced feelings like you're describing in other people?
Yeah, I'm sure that there are hymns that focus on the justice of God, and I'm sure that there might even be man-made songs that encourage the singer to sing something along the lines of, you know, I haven't done anything wrong. Why are these things happening to me? But I think most writers, especially in modernity, would be, and I think for good reason, very hesitant to write those sorts of things. Because it's easy to write words that exalt God, words that praise how great God is. Like, that's an easy thing to do. It's easy to write songs that thank God for the gospel. But I feel like there is a weightiness of, like, I wouldn't feel comfortable writing something about how, I mean, pastors do have to do this when they write sermons, but writing something that glorifies the justice of God and talks about how good it is that sinners will burn in hell for eternity. Like, pastors have to do that, admittedly. But I think most songwriters don't go there. Sometimes, I'm not saying these songs don't exist, but I think the ones that do are rarely sung in most churches.
True.
And that's kind of what I mean, I guess, is, well, and I guess I'm going to get into this, but does that help answer your question?
Yes.
And I shouldn't say that the Psalms only cut down in that episode of the Balm in Gilead. I've got nothing. Jim read Psalm 24, which is an excellent example that builds our trust in Christ as King. We often sing it at church to the tune of "To God be the glory, great things he has done." And I think it's an extremely encouraging song and a better song than Mighty to Save, because I don't know, it's just more thorough. It's more holistic. And you know, God wrote it, so you can't argue with me.
Are you saying that because Mighty to Save is a paraphrase of Psalm 24 or a take?
The notion of like a mighty King Savior.
Oh, okay. Just has some common
right. words. Right. And Brian drew the parallel to "Give Us Clean Hands." I think it's ironic that each of those songs focuses on just one aspect, whereas the Psalm in relatively few verses manages to pull in both of these concepts and sing about both of them. Sometimes I feel like when I'm singing the Psalms, I have to just keep up with what's going on. Although hymns do that too. There are a lot of hymns where like verse one, you're focusing on one thing, like creation. And then verse two, you're focusing on the fall. And verse three, you're hymns are not, I think a lot, it's a trait of modern worship songs often to focus on exactly one or two things. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So what I mean to say, I guess, is that the Psalms have everything modern worship songs and hymns have, and far, far more. They're less like it singing a chorus or a chant and more like singing a sermon, because they're sometimes convicting, they're sometimes encouraging, but you get the sense while you're singing them. It's a weird sense, and I can't describe it. I feel like my description is not going to do it justice, but you get the sense that God himself is speaking to you in the words that you and others around you are singing. And I mean, that's because that's what's happening, but you get that sense. That sense that like, I'm singing these things, and these may be convicting things, but they are things that God himself said and he's saying to me. And it's kind of, at times it's an overwhelming experience.
Does that same sensation occur when you're listening to a sermon? A man-made written sermon off of the word of God, and he is speaking as God. Do you get that same level of conviction from a sermon or just Psalms?
I certainly can get that same level of conviction from a sermon. Especially when the tie between the text and what's being said is eminently clear.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to pick fights. I'm just, it's hard because like, if you want to fight with me, I can't really prove any of the things that I'm saying. I've simply experienced them. And the only way to determine that I am wrong, or at least wrong for your experience, would be to experience them, you know, and then we could talk.
Yeah. Today, most of this seems to be very experience-based, and I don't want to be in that business of pitting mine against yours.
Right.
Because what are we even doing? You know, what is that going to accomplish? Right.
And I guess I'm bringing these things up just so that people who haven't ever sung Psalms or who have rarely sung Psalms have some concept of what they might be missing out on. That like, if you're not feeling these things, like I can tell you as somebody who moved from hymns and modern worship songs to singing Psalms exclusively, that these are some things that I thought were relatively unique or at least I experienced in greater measure, through singing Psalms.
One should, if listening to your words, if they're not singing Psalms, should at least consider this because, for at least this reason, there's lots of reasons,
right.
But like there are problems that we have that you don't. And one of those problems, one of those problems is sometimes we have to be very discerning of the songs we sing. Mm.
There are even songs that have been sung in our church that I refuse to sing because of inherent problems that I believe are there within the text of the song. And so I'm kind of, I have to be sometimes on my guard. And when I am singing, I'm evaluating. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be doing that while I'm singing. I mean, I shouldn't be doing that. I shouldn't have to be doing
that. Well, I mean, it would be great if you knew about the songs beforehand, you know, because then you could evaluate and then come to church ready to sing them.
That's true. That's true. But that aside, those are things that you don't have to do.
Right. Yes.
You don't have to worry about that at all. And that must be really cool. And that must be a weight that you just don't have to carry.
I think that's why
those are processes that you don't have to go through in your head.
I think that's
during.
Yeah,
that's great.
That's why that's it's great. Different from hearing a sermon, because in hearing a sermon, I'm still doing that. Like even at an RP church, like a Reformed Presbyterian church, I'm still evaluating and thinking, well, I don't know if I agree with that. Calvin said this, you know, like I'm still doing that, but I don't do that when the pastor's just reading out of 2 Samuel. Like I'm not sitting there thinking, well, I don't know if that verse is correct. And the Psalms are more like hearing the pastor read scripture to you than they are like the sermon. I mean, at the end of the day, if the pastor is speaking something from the scripture, you should have that sense. And it is true that God is speaking to you through the pastor.
Yeah.
But you have to, the scriptures tell us to be discerning about these things, but you don't have to be discerning when the scriptures are being read.
Right. Yeah, the Johns should be a reason enough or evidence enough that that has to be done. But okay, anyways.
So you brought this up. I almost dropped the point, but I think it might be worthwhile. I have to wonder if this sensation of fear at the things that I'm singing isn't one of the reasons why psalm singing has fallen on such hard times. So
could you rephrase that? I didn't follow. You said fear.
The sensation of like, oh, God is a just God and I need to repent of known sin and I need to trust Christ.
Oh.
Like, I wonder if that fear, that sense and the things that I've been talking about isn't one of the reasons why psalm singing has fallen on hard times. So I believe that Romans 1 teaches us that unbelievers who walk into church know that they are sinners against a holy God. And many churches have gone out of their way to remove sin and damnation from the sermons. But if you sing the Psalms, you can't get rid of it. So like I could see myself almost being tempted to do this if I were a pastor or even back when I was a youth pastor. Because if we had songs where like I watched people come to youth group, sing them, kind of stop halfway through, be like, what the frick is this? And then never saw them again. I don't know if I would sing that song again. I'd like if I would encourage our group or our congregation or what have you to sing that psalm again. Mm-hmm. And so you phase out the more convicting ones and then the somewhat convicting ones until you're left with very few psalms, because almost all of them have, not almost all of them, but many of them have some one or two verses at least that make you feel like, oh, like God is righteous and I'm not. And so then you supplement them your collection with man-made songs. And before you know it, by catering to the tastes of the unregenerate guest and the hypocritical members, you have phased out all but the positive feelings and encouragement from your church's worship. And I don't think that's how it happens in every church, but I think it may be how it happens in some churches. And then that kind of starts to shape the culture of what people expect from church. And then it becomes even harder to be I remember when I came into our RP church, one of the first things we met one of the elders, and one of the first things he talked about was, hey, you might've noticed that our worship is a little different. And he felt like he really just needed to defend the fact that we even sing the Psalms. And then beyond that, the fact that we only sing the Psalms, because he's just so used to people coming in, hearing the Psalms sang, thinking it's weird and leaving. And I think I'm not saying that he was wrong to do that he was wrong to explain to us. I think that's a very healthy and helpful and pastoral instinct that he had. We it wasn't necessary with us because that's why we were there. But I think that with a lot of even Christians coming in and singing about how God's going to punch the wicked in the jaw, that could be very off-putting and that a lot of Christians would just walk out. So one other thought that I had, do you have anything to respond to that?
Right. I think you're speaking to kind of some seeker sensitive sensibilities. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think you're right. the solution for those kinds of churches is going to move or be far beyond just singing psalms. Those churches are doing those things for a variety of reasons. Yep. That that kind of fix is not, that's going to be not that effective. But there are churches that do not sing psalms exclusively, but are protecting that kind of truth. Yeah. That God is going to punch the jaw of the wicked, and can, it is possible to have those values inherent in the songs that you sing, in the sermons that you preach, and the values of the congregants that are there together as a family. So I do want to stress that. I mean, it's not, you know, there's RPCNA churches than everybody else. There is a variety here.
Right.
And I think that these things can be protected in ways other than exclusive psalmody, but I can't really disagree with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because there are things you can't really get away with if you're singing the psalms exclusively.
Right. Yeah. And I also just want to say, I wonder, like we talk about how, yeah, it's theoretically possible for a man-made song or for a church to sing man-made psalms and for songs, and for those songs to be convicting, for those songs to be about God's justice in a way that makes people uncomfortable. But I wonder if we're not kind of talking like people who want to institute communism in America, where like,
this is interesting.
It's a good system. We can have man-made songs that do these things, but like point to a country that hasn't been completely devastated whenever they've tried communism. Like, okay. I would be interested if somebody who knows far more about church history than I can point to a church where they, especially if they just all but like completely stopped singing psalms. But then even if they had a 50-50 mix, I'd be interested to find the church that for a generation or two sang man-made songs that were convicting and that were about God's justice. Like, I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I do wonder if it's one of those systems, obviously holding the convictions I do on exclusive psalmody. I'm a bit biased here, but I wonder how possible it is. Like, we talk about how it's theoretically possible. Like, of course, in theory, there's nothing preventing. It's not like somebody who's trying to do that is suddenly going to get a cramp and not be able to write anymore. Like, there's no physical barrier preventing it. But is the heart of man such that churches that veer away from the Psalms will do insofar as they continue in that direction, slowly move away from singing about the things that we've been talking about? It's a theory. Okay,
so could you distill that down into a simple statement? Because you had a very
roundabout
long way of explaining that one point. Are you saying that you want an example of a church that
does that sing either all or mostly man-made hymns and songs, but that does emphasize God's justice in the singing
for a certain period of time?
Yeah, for even just, I don't know, a decade or two. Okay. Yeah, I would just be, you know, I know we have listeners on the show who are more expert in church history than I, and they may be able to point to an era or even point, show me some of, you know, Watts's songs or something.
Yeah, they may be members of churches that have done.
True.
This.
One of our listeners might be able to say, well, actually we sing, and provide me some lyrics, and I'll be like, whoa, that's great. Cool. But you should still only sing the Psalms, 'cause that's my position.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, as we were saying it, I kept thinking of liberals talking about how, well, I mean, communism is a great system. It's just never been implemented correctly.
Okay. And you're thinking that this system of not singing or singing minimally a psalms, you're saying that a church that does that but upholds the truths that that psalm singing would promote, you're saying that that is also equivalent to this communist country that it works.
Yeah, I'm saying I wonder if those exist as frequently as successful communist governments. Okay. It's a silly metaphor, but it's just something that popped into my head. And I thought it would be a helpful metaphor, but I think it just obscured things more.
Oh, I think I got it. I just had to have you explain it a little bit.
Anyway, one last thought or two here is that I think that as one becomes more familiar, and I think this might have happened to you, with biblical metaphor, the meaning of the sacrifices, the ceremonial systems of the Old Testament, and even other kind of one-off metaphors like Moses lifting up the bronze serpent, I think you come to find that the Psalms are maybe the most theologically rich book in all of Scripture. Somebody recently asked me if I could only keep one book of the Bible, you know, if all the Bibles were being burnt and I could only keep one book of the Bible, which one would I want to keep? And I didn't like the question, but my answer was the Psalms. But I don't know if I would recommend that for a new believer. Like for a new believer, I might recommend something like Romans or John, because that might be more holistic, more helpful to them. But I find that by meditating on the words, I can find virtually all of Romans and all of John and all of Genesis taught in the Psalms. And since I have it in Psalm form, I get to sing about it.
Because your teacher Romans taught
exactly,
you how to
exactly. Find it. Yeah. And so, yeah, you get me. Hopefully the audience gets me. And then one last point, and this is just a response to something that Brian said. I did want to mention that the Scottish metrical Psalter has been said by the Westminster Divines, or some of the Westminster Divines, to be a better translation of the Psalms than the KJV Bible. Now, Brian had said that any metrical rhyming version of the Psalter is definitionally or must be a paraphrase. And that statement gets into some very complex theory about meaning, about translation theory. So when you come across the Hebrew word for bowels, he felt this way in his bowels. Is it a paraphrase to render bowels as heart? Is the meaning of the word Hebrew word bowels in that context bound up in the anatomical location or the fact that it was culturally considered the seat of the affection? Or do you go the NASB route, ditch the metaphor altogether and say out of his innermost being, you know, he feels this in his innermost being. Like, mm-hmm. Any of those three, you could argue, are not perfect translations. There's somebody saying, I think this is at the heart of the word that was used, and I'm not going to translate it over as if I was translating an anatomy textbook.
So kind of like what a good songwriter would do when they want to write a hymn.
Right. And so I find that, I don't know, I could be really liberal here. As I've thought about these things, I find that the distinction between literal and paraphrastic or dynamic equivalents and formal equivalents is not as clear a line, because when the ESV renders bowels as heart, I think a lot of people would want to make the case that that's clearer and more helpful and a better translation. It carries across the actual original meaning more than when the KJV says bowels.
So a translation of the meaning, not the translation of the text.
Yeah, not the dictionary translation of. But that's the thing is when you look in the dictionary and you see heart, you know, you look up heart in the dictionary, you will find the ones that are about the anatomy of the subject, and then you'll find something along the lines of the seat of the affections. And this is the problem of translation, is that like,
does one have to decide if the original text usage of the word bowel? You kind of have to decide if that's like what not what are you saying? Are you saying it's not clear enough? Are you saying it's not proper that we use the word bowel because it will not be good in a song? It won't sing well. Are those questions that are they allowed to ask those questions?
I think what I'm saying,
or should they just translate? Because I think that the original manuscript of the Psalms. I mean, if the Psalter is a good translation of the Psalms, better than perhaps the KJV, well, in the original manuscript, are they written as metrical Psalms? Then, if it's better,
there's a lot that goes into answering that. So it might sound like I'm not answering your question.
And if we had time, we would get into that.
what I'm trying to say is that no matter what you do, when you bring over that word, I can't remember what the Hebrew word for bowels is, but when you bring that word over, you're going to pick two or three out of the five possible dictionary definitions of what that word meant in Hebrew that are going to come across with the word that you choose in English. And for that reason, translation is something of an art form. And when you're translating, you have to ask the question of what is the purpose of this? If you're writing a translation that is for academic purposes, for preachers, you should translate it as bowels, because you should trust that the person reading it, explaining it to his congregation, is going to explain why it's the word bowels. And you should trust that that congregation is eventually going to come to be shaped by like their language usage. They'll start saying, oh, I felt it in my bowels, because they've heard it so many times in the reading of the scriptures or what have you. But if you are writing a translation that's maybe for everyday use, for congregant use, going with heart might not be a bad idea. And I wouldn't call the translation a paraphrase because of that. I would say that you have managed to use a word that communicates what the original word communicated, even if it is not as technically, like you hit the third definition of the word in the dictionary, because that's what how it was being used, not the first definition of the word in the dictionary. But I don't know that, I think that might be an arbitrary distinction anyway. So the notion of converting, I think one of the reasons that the divines, and I'm talking out of my butt here, so stop me. But I think one of the reasons that the divines considered it a better translation is because when we read something in meter that rhymes, we read it as being metaphorical and poetic. And when we read something that's not like that, we read it as being prose. But to a Hebrew mind, reading the Psalms, it came across as metaphorical and poetic. So if by making a couple minor things that don't actually change the meaning of any of the words as they were originally intended, if by doing that, you can communicate more the notion that this is poetic and metaphorical, you've actually come up with a more faithful translation, not a less faithful translation.
That might be a bit of a stretch to say that it's more faithful.
That's what the Westminster Divine said. And these are guys who read their Bible in Hebrew every morning. So yeah, they recommended that to their congregation for their reading, that kind of thing. So I don't know. All that I'm trying to say is I think having only barely dipped my baby toe into the shallow end of the kiddie pool when it comes to translation and translation theory, I think a statement like metrical psalters are inherently paraphrases is maybe a little bit of an overstatement, at least. And that for my part, I'm content to side with the theologians and the exegetes, the guys who read the Hebrew Bible in the morning with their coffee, those guys that I trust the most. And there are modern scholars who say this too.
It's now occurring to me, now that we're at the end of this section, I have to go to home group in 12 minutes.
You're welcome.
That you heard that podcast and had a few things to say, didn't you? And you said it with me. So I got to listen to it. But I think you really wanted to say this to Brian, didn't you?
You know, you might be right. I mean, I'm not on that show.
Let's get you on that podcast next, because I think they really want you on that show.
It would have to be structured like this, where it's largely experiential. My last point was really just, it was the one that I was most uncomfortable making, because it is sort of a theological point. But really all I'm trying to do is say, actually, there are some really smart people who believe this, and I think there might be good reasons.
Okay. Well, I hope this was useful to our audience. You're probably going to have to listen to the Balm and Gilead podcast too.
If you want to do a bumper for the beginning of the episode, or just toss it in at some point, that might be helpful.
Okay, I will have to do that. But we're going to have to end the show. And we'll have to cover the next topic at a later date, as fun as that will be. So yeah, that was fun to listen to. And we're gonna have to end the show. So it's been fun to talk about some theology-ish stuff. This feels like old times. Feel very nostalgic. My neck is exposed, and I think it's time to end the show. Nostalgia, the neck.
Oh, you know, right.
It's the Dwight joke.
I'm sorry. I was going all the way back to the rodeo reference we made earlier.
Okay. Well, all right. See everybody later.
Bye.
Won't someone save me from this podcast? Is it over or just dragging along? Will these two guys talk forever? Or will they quit if I sing them this song? My back is sore from all this flagellation. Podcast. The torture started off so tongue in cheek. Now it seems it's almost over. So I'll just have to wait another week. I'm gonna miss all the self-deprecation. them all.